Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mat-Su Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, just about everywhere. Just search for Dog Works Radio, and calling in from California is the co-host of Mushing Radio. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Robert. It's been cold down here, but, you know, for us, cold means the 40s.
Yeah, we talked about that last episode, whether you guys break out the parkas at 40 degrees and, you know, turn up the heat and all that. You know, I have a question about that. I was going to ask you the last time I was listening to a show that was aired in Los Angeles, and it's my understanding that it's relatively warm in the day, but at night it gets real cold because of the way that the terrain is, you know, the way that things are set up, because it's sort of in a valley-type desert situation where it can get pretty cold pretty quick and temperatures change real rapidly. Is that true?
Generally that tends to be true. And the other thing about the weather down here is for most of the time, for the majority of days, it will be sunny. So even if the temperature isn't necessarily all that warm, if you're out in the sunshine, you tend to feel warmer than if it's cloudy and windy.
Right. So you guys got your wool socks on and your park is at 40 degrees and ready to rock and roll and talk about some mushing on the radio, right?
Exactly. That's how we roll down here.
There he go. So on our last episode, Alex, we talked about the 1925 serum run and how all of that sort of works its way out in history. And now we're going to talk about the aftermath of that. Do you want to do a real quick summary of the serum run so folks that did not get a chance to listen to it may get some a heads up before we move into the next history segment?
Sure, absolutely. Just as a reminder, those who didn't listen, you can go back and listen to the archived show, which I would definitely recommend. In 1925, there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, Alaska, and they were scheduled to get antitoxin to treat the diphtheria, but it hadn't come in on the last boat, and then the seas froze, so they weren't able to get it in over the winter. And there was a fear that this diphtheria outbreak could spread and could kill hundreds or possibly thousands of people. So a decision was made to bring in antitoxin, but because it was 1925, there were not very many planes that were equipped to fly from Anchorage to Nome. Most of the planes that were in service then, the commercial planes, were open cockpit planes, and it was very cold. The engines were not as reliable during the winter. So the decision was made to bring the antitoxin by dog sled. And it was decided that the easiest way to do this would be to ship the antitoxin by train up to Nenana, and then move it across, essentially on the Iditarod Trail, on a lot of the same ground that was run in this past year's Iditarod, and do a team of dog sled relays. So there were a number of dog sled teams that made trips of various lengths, each handing it off to the next musher who would bring it further and further. And as we discussed last time, the most important two mushers who were part of this relay were Leonard Sepala with his lead dog Togo and Balto, which was the lead dog for his name has escaped me.
Gunnar Kassen.
Gunnar Kassen, right.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you, Alex, for the quick summary. And we're going to pick up the story from there to talk about the little Norwegian musher with his little Siberians, Leonard Sepala. You know, a lot of people know the name when they hear anything about mushing. They hear the name Sepala. They know about the Siberian Husky. I'm a big proponent of the Siberians. We've had them for years in our kennel. And they're just a magnificent little breed. And I think things would have changed a little bit differently if Leonard Sepala was not involved with the serum run. And it's interesting how history sort of played its way out after the serum run. And I'm just going to read a little bit of information that I have from the internet, and then we can talk about it. Is that okay, Alex?
Absolutely.
So after the serum run, Sepala and some 40 of his dogs toured the lower 48 with an Eskimo handler. His tour ended in 1927 with a dog sled race at Poland Springs, Maine, where he accepted the challenge to race against Arthur Walden, the founder of the North New England Sled Dog Club and the owner of the famous lead dog Chinook. Despite a series of time-consuming mishaps on the trail, Sepala won the race against the bigger, slower dogs driven by Walden and his followers. The enthusiasm for sled dog racing in New England, together with the serum run publicity and the victory over Walden, made it possible for Sepala to partner with Elizabeth Ricker to establish the Siberian Husky Club at Poland Springs, Maine. This was the start of the spread of the Sepala sled dog in the United States and in Canada. In 1928, Sepala moved to his permanent home to near Fairbanks, Alaska, and in 1931, Ricker's partnership ended with him. Sled dog racing was a demonstration event at Lake Placid in 1932, where he earned a silver medal in the event. In 1946, he and his wife, Constance, moved to Seattle, Washington. In 1961, Sepala revisited Fairbanks and other places in Alaska at the invitation of the American journalist Lowell Thomas, enjoying a warm reception from the Alaskan people. Him and his wife lived in Seattle until his death at the age of 89. His wife Constance died a few years later at 88. Both are buried in Nome, Alaska. So you know, Alex, a pretty quick summary about him. But what was interesting, and we're going to talk about this on the next show with Kassen and Togo, these guys were some of the earliest rock stars, weren't they, in terms of celebrities. They really threw out the red carpet for these folks. They toured, you know, the lower 48. All of a sudden, sled dogs were on the map. What can you tell us about the Sepala saga and how he sort of became this celebrity in a time in America where, you know, news and the internet and movies and all that sort of stuff were relatively new, at least in terms of movies and film? I think it sort of changed the way people thought about mushing at that point. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And as we discussed a little bit last time, while the serum run was going on, which was sometimes called the Great Race for Mercy and known by a couple of other names, it was reported very widely in newspapers and followed by people all around the world. But because there weren't satellites and radio transmissions were harder to relay, almost all of the coverage was in print. And people would be following all of the mushers and be following how far along the trail they were and who had gone which distance. Throughout all of this, Leonard Sepala was considered one of the most important members of this relay team. And in fact, when they were planning how to get the serum from Anchorage out to Nome, one of the ideas that was floated was to have someone take it halfway and then have one team take it the other half, to meet in the middle and take it, you know, one half at a time. And Cephala was willing and able to go half of the race, which essentially would mean going about 1,000 miles, because he would have had to start in Nome and then go to the halfway point, then turn around with the serum and come back.
Right. And, you know, what I found it pretty interesting is we talked about these rock stars and how they sort of, you know, sort of made a big to-do about what a lot of folks didn't know much about because of the way that the news covered things back in, you know, the early 20th century. But what I thought was the coolest part of this was how they introduced sled dog sports to the Olympics in 1932 at Lake Placid. And as we mentioned, he won the silver medal in that event, and it took place with five contestants, five from Canada, or 12 contestants, five from Canada and seven from the United States. And it was run under the rules of the New England Sled Dog Club, twice over a 25.1 mile long course with six dogs per sled. Each sled took off at 3-minute intervals, and immediate times were given to the mushers at 4 miles, 10.6 miles, and 22.46 miles. So if folks know much about sprint mushing, this was a sprint race in the Olympics. It was the only time, to my knowledge, that sled dog sports have been a part of the Olympics, and it was set up real close to the way the Ferrandi is run, which is a very very big race here in Anchorage. It's been around at least as long as this, I believe, this 1932 Olympics. So what do you think about sled dog sports in the Olympics? I would like to see it at least, you know, maybe as a demonstration again. What do you think?
I would absolutely love to see sled dog racing in the Olympics. I think it would be very, very exciting and very fun to watch. You know, a lot of us who are interested in mushing and in the Iditarod, when we first learn about it, one of the things that is so attractive and compelling is watching the dogs. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past many times, but these dogs are just phenomenal athletes. And for many of us, we're used to thinking of dogs solely as pets or perhaps as service dogs. We don't realize how much concentration and power and focus these animals can have. And so, you know, we look at some of these dogs running on sled teams, and even though they are definitely, many of them, especially the Siberians, are just beautiful, gorgeous animals, they also are just such amazing athletes. And I would love to see dog sledding in the Olympics, if only because I think that would put a lot more focus on how great the athletes, the real athletes, the dogs are.
I totally agree. And it's my understanding the only events that have an animal are the equestrian events, and obviously that's in the Summer Olympics. How do you feel about that in terms of, you know, it's almost a human-powered, you know, spectacle the Olympics are. Do you think that sort of changes the way that the Olympics are set up, going from more human performance events versus events that have another component, whether it be dogs or horses?
You know, I think it would be fascinating to watch, just because as having the animal component definitely changes it, but it also is about how the humans interact with their canine athletes and how they train with them. And I think that would be really wonderful and amazing, and would be a great would be a great way to introduce people to the sport as well. I wanted to mention just very briefly that looking at the list of competitors for the 1932 demonstration in Lake Placid, I noticed that one of them was Colonel Norman Vaughn, who came in 11th place, second to last. But Colonel Norman Vaughn, I believe, is someone we've touched upon a few times, is someone who ran the Iditarod a number of times, climbed a mountain in Antarctica that I believe is named after him now, and was very active in the Serum Run reenactments that were done in Alaska more recently.
Right, and I was just going to mention that the qualification to run in these Olympic Games, Norman Vaughn, as you mentioned, qualified and came in 11th. But what I found was interesting was Emil St. Goddard. He was unable to compete because of lack of financial support. You know, even in today's day and age in mushing, that's always a factor. And I know you and I have talked a lot about it on this show, about the corporate sponsors and how all that worked out. But that also is an interesting twist to the Olympics, because just up until recent times, it was considered an amateur event. You know, Michael Phelps and all those guys didn't have the big corporate sponsors when they first started. Now all of a sudden, everybody's is represented by, you know, the athletic companies, whether it be Nike or Adidas or Under Armour or whoever it is. But even back in 1932, they were still going after those corporate sponsors, which play hand in hand to a lot of mushing events. What is your take on that in the Olympics back in the day and even today?
You know, it always was a little bit of a strange differentiation to make, because in the communist bloc, the athletes were essentially supported by the state, and that was not allowed in the West. So you always had the situation where athletes from the Soviet Union would be much better trained, would be able to to devote all of their time full time to training and competing in sports, whereas athletes in the West would often have to have jobs, and there were only specific jobs that they could have. They couldn't have a job that was too related to the sport they were competing in, because then they were considered professionals as opposed to amateurs. Although there is just a lot of money now in the Olympics and in training the athletes and needing to bring in corporate sponsors, from a fan standpoint, I am much happier seeing the best athletes in the world in whatever sport, whether it's, you know, basketball or other sports where people make a living as professionals, or just, you know, sports like bobsled racing, where you know that you don't have to worry about whether someone took some sort of skiing gig or some sort of job representing a particular equipment manufacturing company that would in the past have disqualified them from competing in the Olympics.
Right. So to finish up for today, we wanted to just give down the listings of where he stood there in the Olympics. As we mentioned, he was in second place. Emil St. Goddard, it said that he couldn't compete, but for whatever reason, it shows him at first place. I don't know why that is, Alex, but I'm just reading here on the page. Emil was in first, Leonard Seppala second, Shorty Russick, I believe is how you pronounce his name, a Canadian, was in third, Harry Wheeler, also a Canadian, in fourth, Roger Haynes, from United States, was fifth, Raymond Poyet, I believe is how you pronounce that, is in sixth, Jack Del Falco, seventh, Stuart Belkamp at 8th, Harry Murphy 9th, Dexter Sears 10th, Norman Vaughn 11th, and a woman, Eva Seeley, competed, and she was in 12th. I find that amazing. If you know anything about Short Seeley, that's also another good story maybe we can tell in the future. But as we talk about Seppala, you know, his legacy sort of lives on, and to close the show, there is an award for a participant in the Iditarod called the Leonard Seppala Award. What can you tell us about that one?
Well, you know, Leonard Seppala is considered among among all fans of dog racing, is considered pretty much, I would say, the seminal figure in dog racing. And so the Leonard Seppala Award is one of the most highly thought of and coveted awards that is given out in the Iditarod. I'm not sure if it has been given from the first race. Do you know that offhand?
I don't know right offhand.
Okay, but anyway, the Seppala Award is considered the humanitarian award. So it is given to it's given to the musher who, I believe, I'm not sure what the exact wording of it is, but I believe it is given to the musher who best exemplifies the spirit of the Iditarod, particularly with regard to dog care.
Right, right.
Is that correct?
I believe, yes. It's different than the Vet Award. That's a very highly coveted award as well. But the Humanitarian Award is a very coveted award in the Iditarod in that it's one of those that you know that everybody's striving to get. Usually, when you attend a mushing event, there are several awards that are given at every race. One of them is the Humanitarian or Sportsmanship Award. The other one is the Vet Award. And, of course, all the awards for first and second place. And then, of course, the Red Lantern. So I believe even in the Iditarod, if you don't win, if you get one of these highly coveted awards, including the Leonard Seppala Humanitarian Award, it shows your respect for the trail. It shows your competitiveness. It shows you out there on the trail doing what you're supposed to do and just not out there going through the paces and, you know, making your way to Nome. You're doing something very special out there on the trail to get this Seppala Award.
Right. And a lot of times these awards recognize the sort of intangible things that mushers do on the trail, whether it is stopping to help somebody, making sure that things are safe for other competitors. But it's that sort of activity that is really not just looking out for yourself and looking out for your team and looking out for how well you do in the race, but really looking out for everyone and making sure that everyone is able to complete the race and everyone is able to stay safe.
Exactly. Well, Alex, we're out of time here for today's show. Anything you want to say in closing?
You know, people who want to learn more about either the Serum Run or Leonard Seppala, I would encourage people to do that. There are a bunch of books that we've talked about in the past that have a lot of information on them. For me, the more I learn about these people, these seminal figures in mushing and the history of mushing, the more inspirational it is, and the more, frankly, I see what they set up and what they strove to do carried forward in almost all mushers that I meet today.
Excellent. Well, Alex, thank you very much for joining us, and until next time, goodbye.
Thanks.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forteau. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com, iTunes, Facebook, not everywhere. Just search for DogWorks Radio in the search bar, and it'll pull us right back up. On the line, calling in from California, is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Robert. It's always exciting to be with you and talking about dogs and mushing.
It is fun to talk about it. You know, up here in Alaska, we're gearing up for the racing season, and as they spoke about earlier in the year, we may have a difficult winter up here, and the first big race of the year has already been canceled. The qualifying race, the Kinnick 200, was just announced that it was canceled this past week. So I don't know, Alex. We have plenty of snow here. I'm right outside here at my cabin in Willow, and we have plenty of snow on the ground. But to the further east or the further south you go, conditions are not as they should be as we head into the new year.
Yeah, and we've had a couple of years where there just has not been as much snow as we need and as people want. And you know, a lot of us are worried that this is perhaps going to become the new normal for how the winters are going to be.
You know, I hope not. Somehow or another, they always end up pulling the Iditarod off that first Saturday and Sunday in March. But, you know, they do dry land kart racing all over the world. It's a huge event, even in places like South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. You know, mushing still carries on without snow, but it's a much different animal, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also, you know, part of, I think, what makes talking about the Iditarod and other major races so exciting is that there is the element in it of just having to deal not only with long distances but extremes of weather. And I think for a fan, that element makes watching and following the races much more exciting.
I totally agree. So hopefully the rest of the winter plays itself out and we get enough snow to have the rest of the qualifying races, because it becomes very difficult for new rookies to enter into the fold when every year a race or two is canceled. You know, I've signed up for qualifiers the last 3 or 4 years, and every year one seems to get canceled in my quest to run the Iditarod. And what's interesting about that, Alex, which a lot of people I don't think know, is if it takes 4 or 5 years to qualify for the Iditarod, you have to have a whole other batch of dogs in order to run that race from when you first started that kennel 4 or 5 years ago, huh?
Right. And, you know, not to mention the fact that, as we've talked about in the past, takes a significant amount of energy, time, and money to put together an Iditarod team and to qualify for the Iditarod. And if you're doing that over the course of 2 or 3 years, that is a big challenge. But if you're doing that over the course of 4 or 5 years, that's just takes the challenge to a whole other level.
It does. And, you know, for our kennel here, it costs about $24,000 to $30,000 a year just for food. That doesn't include anything else. You know, not bragging there at all, Alex, but it is a very expensive endeavor to take part in. And that's just for feeding. That's not for traveling to races, signing up, et cetera. So if you do that 3 or 4 years, you've already put in $100,000 just in dog food.
Right. And right, as you mentioned, that's not counting anything else. It's not counting your vet bills, which if you're having a kennel that has 30 or 40 dogs, can be substantial.
It can, and of course the gear and all that as well. So, Alex, on our last episode, we talked about the aftermath of the serum run, the 1925 serum run, and you gave a brief history of it. You can listen to that episode over on Dog Works Radio. We talked about Leonard Seppala and his dog Togo and about what happened with them, how they traveled around and became celebrities, and how Seppala ran in the 1932 Olympic Games when it was a demonstration sport. He came in second place receiving a silver medal, and how he sort of lived out his days under the fame of that event. And at the end of the show, we talked about the Leonard Seppala Award that is given out in the Iditarod, and we were kind of floundering a little bit about when it started and, you know, who receives it, et cetera. So on today's show, I wanted to give a little bit of correction on that so we can make sure that our listeners know we do know what we're talking about, but sometimes we need to look up it on the Internet. The highly coveted Leonard Seppala Award demonstrates outstanding care for his or her team throughout the race while remaining competitive. Upon arrival in Nome, each of the top 20 teams will be judged on those criteria. The recipient of the award receives a beautiful engraved lead crystal trophy and a free entry to the next year's Iditarod. It was first given out in 1982 to Joe May. I know we talked about Joe in our decades of the Iditarod. We talked about him several times. And the first couple of years, it was given to Rick Mackey, Bert Baumhoff, I believe is how to pronounce it, Libby Riddles, Rich Atkinson, and Dave Olson. And Martin Busser, the first big name to receive it there, got it in 1988. So that's what the Leonard Seppala Humanitarian Award is all about. So it sort of is that Vet Choice Award that we mentioned on last week's show.
Mm-hmm. And it's voted by the vets. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe it's voted by the vets. So you have to be, you have to remain competitive. You have to be in the top 20. So it's not one of those things that that any musher can get. They have to be very competitive in order to receive that. And I didn't know that they got a free entry to next year's race. That's a pretty coveted prize in and of itself.
Yeah, especially these days when you know, when the entry fee for the race has gone up considerably. So, you know, saving yourself several thousand dollars is a very, very good thing.
So let's talk about Balto and Gunnar Kassen. You know, when we talk about the serum run, when we talk about dog sledding, I don't think there is a dog out there that is more popular than Balto. He's been part of movies and children's books and cartoons, and, you know, Disney has made things about him, and he has a statue in New York City. You know, everybody knows Balto, don't they?
Right. And this is, we touched upon this a couple weeks ago, but there's a bit of a controversy between who made the more significant contribution. Kassen and Balto are much better known, but Leonard Seppala and his dog Togo are considered much more integral to the success of the serum run and went considerably longer than anybody else who ran the serum from out to Nome. So there is some controversy also because Kassen was supposed to change and give the serum to another team in safety. But Ed Roan, the other musher, was asleep and there was a blizzard. He was asleep. He was expecting that Kassen would be coming in later. And when Kassen came in, he decided that it would take more time to wake up Roan and get his dogs in harness and give him the serum than to just keep going. And he felt that his dogs were in very good condition, and it's only 22 miles from safety to Nome, so he felt that that would be a better way to do it. And some have accused him of trying to hog the glory because there was a lot more attention paid to the person who brought the serum into Nome in the final leg than most of the other mushers who, you know, took the serum for 25 or 40 miles.
And, you know, after the serum run, we talked in last week's show about these guys becoming celebrities, and Kasson and Balto truly became celebrities. And, you know, this story doesn't have necessarily the happy ending that a lot of people wish it would. Just 10 months after the serum run in December of 1925, they erected a statue of Balto in Central Park in New York City, and that statue is still there today, and it leads its way to the Children's Zoo there, and I haven't been able to visit that statue in New York. I know we were in New York City this past summer, but we didn't make it over to Central Park, but there's also a statue of Balto at the start on 4th Avenue here in Anchorage, where they start the Fur Rondi and the Iditarod every year. I'm sure everybody that's been up here has stood in front of that statue and at least taken pictures of it. Do you have one of those pictures in front of Balto there in front of the Fur Rondi headquarters?
I do. I have pictures of that statue, and I have pictures of the statue in Central Park, which I stumbled upon when I was in Central Park a few years back, and I knew it was there, but I wasn't really looking for it, and I just came around a corner and there it was. And, you know, not to take anything away from any of the mushers or from Balto, but there was a lot of resentment that Balto and Kasson were given so much attention and were, you know, were put in movies and toured all around the country, you know, appearing in places like Madison Square Garden and other large cities. And a lot of the other mushers felt that Kasson was really hogging the glory for what all of them had done.
Right. And I want to get into that here in just a second. And you know, you're a big Hollywood guy, and I don't want to put that lightly, Alex. I know that you've shared your, you know, you've rubbed your elbows with a couple of people, so I want to make sure we talk about that here in just a second. But Balto was on hand for the unveiling of this statue in New York in 1925, and there's an inscription there that I want to read, and I think that's going to kind of talk about, you know, why sled dogs are so revered. Dedicated to the indomitable spirit of sled dogs that relayed antitoxin 600 miles over rough ice across treacherous waters through Arctic blizzards from Nenana to the relief-stricken Nome in the winter of 1925. Endurance, fidelity, and intelligence. Pretty powerful words for a little sled dog, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the critics of Kasson and Balto was Leonard Cephalo, whom we talked about last week, last show, who considered Balto to be really not a strong leader in the sense that we think of the word leader, but thought of Balto as really being a very solid second-string dog, a solid dog that would be a member of the team, but not particularly a dog that embodied any of the traits that we associate with being a good leader, being able to follow trail, being able to really set the tone for the rest of the team.
So Balto was not destined to be a star in the breeding shed since he was neutered at a young age. Hence, he was relegated to being neglected on the vaudeville circuit with his team. When Kasson wished to return home to Alaska, his dogs were sold to the highest bidder by the company who sponsored his tour. The dogs ended up chained in a small area in a novelty museum and a freak show in Los Angeles. What do you think about that? So here, all this fame and fortune, and they kind of put these dogs to the wayside, and they became, you know, the sideshow at the local freak show. What do you think about that?
It's really kind of awful for those of us who follow dog sledding and who love dogs. The idea of having these dogs, who, as we've talked about many times, who just love to run, and keeping them in a place where they can't run very often, if at all, and where they are just basically zoo animals to be gawked at is kind of horrible. Not to mention the fact that Los Angeles is not the best climate for sled dogs. Los Angeles is mostly very, very warm. As we've discussed, when it gets cold here, it almost never gets into the 30s. So cold here is in the 40s, and for these dogs, you have, for the most part, heavy coats and rather thick fur. To have them in this type of environment and this type of climate really goes against who they are as animals, and especially for dogs who literally were out when it was 50, 60, 70 below zero and thrived in that condition, to have them in Los Angeles where it's 70 and 80 degrees just seems rather cruel.
I totally agree. But, you know, there was a guy that attempted to rectify the ills. His name was George Kimball. While he was in Los Angeles, he was a former prize fighter turned businessman from Cleveland. He was shocked to discover the care of these dogs and how they were treated, and quickly bought the whole team and brought them to Cleveland in March of 1927. So remember our history timeline here. This is 2 years, almost to the day after the serum run has completed, that these dogs were finally brought to Cleveland, and they received a hero's welcome. They received a parade, the whole nine yards. They were truly treated as heroes, as they should be, and they went on to, you know, to live out their days as heroes, I guess. Balto died in 1933. And he is mounted by a taxidermist and donated to the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And, of course, that movie was made in 1995. I believe it was a Disney movie. I can't recall that. But he was voiced by Kevin Bacon. And you know what they say about Kevin Bacon. Everything is somehow tied to the 7 degrees of separation or 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever they say. It's interesting that this story turns its way back to that sort of allegory, if you will.
Right. And that movie, and a lot of people that I know who don't know a lot about dog sledding or don't know a lot about the Iditarod will mention that movie to me. And it's always sort of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, anything that brings attention to this is not a bad thing. But on the other hand, it's an animated movie. It takes a lot of liberties with what happened. It makes it seem as if Balto was the serum run, took the serum single-handedly all the way to Nome. And it plays fast and loose with the truth.
A typical children's cartoon, not a problem with it at all. It makes the animal the superhero, which is definitely a Disney trait or definitely a animation type trait. It just wouldn't be the children's story if the dog didn't save the day. What do you think?
Yeah, and the dogs, you know, I'm in favor of people looking up to the dogs and viewing the dogs as superheroes. It's if you're above the age of maybe 10 or 11, I think you would find that it's just too simplistic, and that it and that you want to know more of what the real story is. And you know, often with these sort of things, there's, you know, you're trying to balance how to tell the story in a way that will appeal to whoever the intended audience is. And yet there's so much stuff in the real story of what happened that is amazing and heroic as well. So I always feel like it's a bit of a shame that they couldn't have included more of the real stuff that is also wonderful and amazing.
So, Alex, my last point, you had brought it up just a second ago about, really paying homage to the dogs, making sure that they're front and center. And often a lot of folks, even during, current times, during Iditarod times, we really talk about just the musher. You know, we talk about, the Lance Mackeys, the Martin Boosers, the Jeff Kings. We mention them by name as if they are the superstars. And, as a musher, my dogs are the superstars because most likely my dogs will perform just as well, maybe even better, if they were with somebody else on the back of the sled. So I think we do need to pay a little bit more revere, I guess, to the dogs and not so much to the musher. Granted, it's difficult to pay our respects to 1,000-plus sled dogs and everybody knows them by name. But it's interesting because we know, the offensive lineman's name on the pro football team, or the kicker, or the linebacker, or whomever. But we don't necessarily know a lot of these dogs in history. We just know the big name mushers. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And if you talk to pretty much any musher, they will tell you that they're usually the weakest link in the team, that the dogs are capable of so much more, and that the humans are basically just trying to keep up and keep the dogs fed so that the dogs can keep going. But as you mentioned, when you're dealing with over 1,000 different dogs, it's hard to keep track of them. And it's much easier to identify who the humans are and talk about the human stories. I think we've tried pretty consistently to talk about the dogs and to talk about, at the very least, the lead dogs and the important dogs on teams. We've spent a lot of time talking about things like leased teams in the Iditarod, which is not something that gets a lot of coverage, but is a very important factor. But I agree with you. The more we can really learn about and focus on these dogs and who the dogs are and where they came from and how they're trained, the better and more complete view of the sport we're getting.
So, Alex, before we close, I'd mentioned to it there a few minutes ago about the Hollywood spectacle of this. We talked about how Kasson and Balto became the celebrities and, the highlights and the pitfalls of both. And you live in the city of celebrities, and you see how a lot of this works its way out, and maybe you've been to a premiere or two of a movie or of a show and, rubbed elbows with some of these famous people. What is your whole take on this celebrity worship type stuff? I know I've sort of mentioned it even on Twitter in passing in some of our conversations about, are we cheering just because he is a superstar, or are we cheering because he's a musher? What is your take on the whole celebrity worship? Not necessarily with just sled dogs and mushing, but, the whole culture of itself being living in Los Angeles and Hollywood area.
Well, I'm tempted to say that Balto was kind of the Kim Kardashian of sled dogs, but I feel that that's maybe a little bit cruel. There's definitely a lot of that goes on. It's much easier to learn someone's name and follow, the antics of someone who's a celebrity than to really find out what's actually going on. In the mushing world, I think we're sort of lucky that up until recently, even the celebrity mushers have been celebrities in kind of a smaller sense. So they have been people who are very well known and very well regarded in the sled dog world, but outside of that world, they don't really register. I think that is or could be starting to change, especially with people like Dallas Seavey, who are coming up and are recognizing that they can they can leverage the fame that they already have from dog racing in other ways. And so we've seen Dallas doing reality TV shows and things like that. I worry that that is making the world of mushing a little bit less real than it had been before. But on the other hand, I recognize that for someone like Dallas Seavey to run his kennel and be able to remain as competitive as he has been, that takes a lot of money. And so anything that he can do that's building up his brand and that's bringing awareness to him is probably a good thing. I look at the people who are, you know, people who are from the previous generation of mushers, people like Lance Mackey, who really just fundamentally are dog men and women. And they are, you know, they will do interviews and they'll do a little bit of the celebrity and the journalism stuff. But when it comes down to it, what they really want to do is be running dogs. And I think that it's going to be a challenge as we move forward and things become even more expensive, which they always seem to do, to find that balance where people can still retain the integrity that they need and the loyalty to the sport and to their dogs, and yet find a way to be able to get their names out there and to be able to attract sponsorship and to attract attention and just pay for their lifestyle and for this sport.
Yeah, and to come full circle, we started last week's show about talking about becoming celebrities, and even Emile Saint-Goudard and his woes with trying to find sponsorships in order to run in the Olympics, and then of course with Balto and Gunnar Kassen becoming the celebrities that they are. Last question to you, Alex. I know we're running way late on our shows today. Do you think that this celebrity is going to help the sport, or do you think it's going to somehow bring it down? You know, you talked about Kim Kardashian and sort of being the one of the, you know, the outcasts in the Hollywood world. What do you think all this celebrity is going to do to the sport? Do you think it's going to make it grow or make it suffer a little bit?
I think it probably is going to do both. I think that any sort of celebrity and any sort of attention will be good in terms of attracting new sponsors, attracting new fans, just attracting interest to the sport. But as I said, I do worry that it becomes a little bit cheapened by that, and that people might start running the Iditarod and trying to do things with mushing for the wrong reasons. And up until now, it's just been so difficult to get a dog team together and to do your qualifiers and to run the Iditarod that's sort of selected a lot of people out who might have just done this for the wrong reasons. I'm a little worried that will start to happen, but hopefully the people in charge will find ways to make sure that everyone who's running the Iditarod and everyone who's running a lot of these qualifying races are at the very least qualified to do so, or at the very least are people who have the knowledge and the skill that they can compete in a safe and helpful way.
Excellent stuff, Alex. I appreciate your commentary on this. I had to ask the Hollywood point of view. I know that you are the writer, director, promoter, producer, just about everything with Mush, the movie that you did a few years ago, a documentary about the Iditarod and sort of behind the scenes. Real quickly, how do folks get a hold of that? Is it available on your website, Amazon? How can folks get a hold of this movie, even though it's a couple of years old?
MushTheMovie.com is the easiest way.
MushTheMovie.com. Awesome stuff. Well, Alex, we'll talk to you in just a couple of weeks. I'm not sure what we'll talk about, but a whole lot of new topics just came through just talking about on these last couple of weeks' shows. Take care and have a good new year.
You too. Thanks, Robert, and thanks, everyone.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.